get the facts straight as for as what practice actually was, as opposed to any theoretical explanation of this practice or anything else. And the conclusions that we've come to so far are that at no place prior to the 16th century were any Jews did any Jews light candles after sunset. So that the position that we read at the very first shiur, listed explicitly in the Shulchan Aruch as the one and only position as to when Kabbalat Shabbat is, which is some 58 and a half minutes after sunset, was not practiced anywhere, neither in Eretz Israel, nor in southern Europe, nor in northern Europe. It was not a practice that existed. The one deviation from the accepted practice that we did notice, perhaps, in France and Germany, was that they were Makabel Shabbat much, much earlier. That is, an hour or two, maybe three, even before sunset. But we have no record anywhere of Kabbalat Shabbat being postponed beyond the Shkiat HaChama. In Eastern Europe, this changed in the course of the 16th and the 17th century. We found that people were beginning to, from some circumstances, be lighting candles after the Shkia, sometimes well after the Shkia. We saw that in the Magen Avraham, and it may be worthwhile repeating the most striking example of that we saw in this book by Rabbi Safran, a Hasidic Rebbe from the Ukraine in the middle of the 19th century. I'll get a chair from him. Okay. Kol haposkim hiviu devrei Rabbeinu Tam lachalek hashkia shahachama nechnas ba'ovi rakia uven gemar hashkia, that all of the halakhic sources distinguish between, according to Rabbeinu Tam's position, spend some time tonight reading Rabbeinu Tam in the original and how he was interpreted, but distinguishing between the beginning and the end of the Shkia, v'anam lo yodana leklal, we don't make any sense of this whatsoever, ki yadua amidiyata inyan latofnim, as all astronomers know the true facts here, v'chein direi hazoa v'gmara, v'lo yakhish macha shahachush ro'eh, and one cannot deny what is visible to the senses, shahashemesh holechet v'shaveh b'chol hakadur, that the sun rotates evenly around the entire earth. V'kishehu yom lazeh hu laila lazeh, when it's evening in one daylight in one part of the earth, one part of the globe, it's nighttime in another part of the globe. V'lo yesh kan avad shel rakia klal, there's no such thing as the thickness of the firmament which the sun has to go. El ha'ikar shekol zman shehashemesh nirah miktzata al ha'aretz b'chol makom u'makom u'b'chol aklim k'fi mashehu min ha'torah yom gamur, that whatever there is daylight visible at any particular location, then it's considered daytime. V'gam achar sheshaka hachama, and even after the sun has set, ratza la'asod oseh tosefet Shabbat kulo, if one wants to voluntarily take this time after the sun has set and make it into Shabbat, igmei, u'kish mekabel olav Shabbat zman hazeh asur b'melachav yasor lomar l'goy la'asod melacha ki tosefet Shabbat min ha'Torah. V'im ratzal yachol la'asod melacha, but if he wants, he can continue to do work at shalosh revesha achar sheshaka hachama. He can continue working 3/4 of an hour after sunset. V'lo yoteh, but not more than that, ki kanes l'safek haTorah. V'im asor melacha achar avor 50 minut nachrei hashkia chayav v'yasham talud. V'chol zeh l'fi ha'aklim. V'aval b'dinot shelanu yesh chiluk ben chorek l'kayetz. There's a difference between winter and summer. We'll discuss what the difference is between winter and summer a little bit later. It's really a difference between spring and summer, not a difference between winter and summer, but we will look at that. Of course, there's also a difference. Okay, min ha'ra'uy l'chol ba'al nefesh shelo la'asot melacha chatzi sha'a achar hashkia. Nobody should do any work more than a half an hour after sunset. Something which would be completely shocking to anyone living in the United States or in Israel today, but obviously reflected practice in Eastern Europe during that period of time. Now, let's take a look at what was happening in Hungary during the 19th and the 20th century. And for this, I will read a tshuva of Rabiol Ungar, who was a student of the Chatam Sofer. So he lived in the middle of the 19th century. So here's this, a chunk of it. This was written in the middle of the 19th century in the Ukraine. Al dvar she'elato v'tinok hanolad kolim tfilat ha-mincha be'erev Shabbat Kodesh le'erech 50 minut m'kodim yitziyat ha-kochavim. Thought about a boy that was born, obviously after sunset, but some 55 minutes before the tzeit ha-kochavim. Im nechush l'ma she'katav ha-shach b'shem Haram Alashkar, should we worry about the shach who quotes a tshuva of the Maram Alashkar? We will get to that tshuva of the Maram Alashkar either today or Mirz Hashem next week, because it's very important. The yesh lahachmir, that one should go l'chumwa kedak kisvarat harif v'harambam v'harash, the midistamu v'lo katvu shlomshet v'vesha acharei sof hashkia al kain achar tchilat hashkia kod. Should we follow the opinions, seemingly, of the Rambam and others who say that Shabbat begins, or at least Bein HaShemashot, twilight begins immediately after sunset? Should we worry about that opinion? And therefore, this baby boy who was born after sunset should not have his Brit Milah a week from that day. In other words, if, for example, he was born Saturday night after sunset, but before the Tzeit HaKochavim, in this case substantially before, in the case of the Chatam Sofer it was like 20 minutes before, should we pay attention to that opinion which says that Shabbat, or the night, begins with Shkiyat HaChama? Aval HaMagen Avraham V'Ito Kol HaMachabrim HaAchronim, but the Magen Avraham and all later decisors, בשית סימן שישין למרא לו כתב דגמ אם נולד בשabbat רבע מהשעה קודם יציאת הכוכבים. Even if the child was born as late as a quarter of an hour before tzeit hakochavim, mohalim biyomo, the milah is to take place the following Shabbat. So a boy that's born Saturday night, a half an hour, say, after the setting of the sun, as long as it's 15 minutes before tzeit hakochavim, it's still Shabbos, and the writ is on Shabbos. V'gam Adoni Mori v'Rabbi Zal b'chatam sofer hora kein b'siman samach. It should be siman pei. Or chaim l'halacha ulamase. V'katav sheken ki v'em ha-rabotav. U'puk chazi ma'im ha-davar. And look at how people behave here. D'nohagin gam molechet ha-rushut. People continue to do work la'asot b'erev Shabbat acharei hatchalat ha-shkia. Even after the beginning of the sunset, that means after sunset as far as we're concerned, but as far as davening mincha is concerned, they certainly don't follow the opinion that mincha should be prayed before the setting of the sun. So they may be machmir to light candles before sunset Friday night, but that's a distinct and minute minority. Most people here continue to do work after the setting of the sun. And then he goes into a long argument about why the position of Rabbi Eliezer Mimitz is untenable. He seems to not realize that there's a third position, a position that we all follow today, which says that the Shkia marks the onset of the Bein HaShemashot, and therefore the candle lighting has to be done before Shkia, but not an hour before Shkia. All right, now let's skip to the next to the last paragraph, in the middle of that paragraph. Aval anachnu, he writes about three or four lines towards the end of that paragraph. Aval anachnu shiodim al yidei klei hasha'ot sha'od lo higi azman bein hashmashot. If we, who know by looking at the clock that the time of bein hashmashot has not yet arrived, shiyoter mi reva sha'a ad sha'at yitziat ha-kochavim, that there's still 15 minutes left until tzeit ha-kochavim, v'somchim atzmeinu al otam klei sha'od la'asod od melechet b'shut b'erev Shabbat u'l'palal mincha achar kach, to continue to do work on Friday night well after the setting of the sun, and daven mincha afterwards, v'lama lo nesmoch atzmenu gam kein lamol b'yoto hayom. So he takes for granted that the standard practice was continue to work until 15 minutes before Seita Kochavim. How did they know when Seita Kochavim was going to be? How did they tell that it was 15 minutes before? On that, it's not entirely clear to me. That is, they may have had a calculation. That is, they may have had a published calendar or something. I've been searching the library for a Hungarian calendar from the period in question. But I did have an email. Or, so, one possibility, and this is most likely, and I'll read to you that this was in fact the actual practice. If there was a clear night the night before, they would look and see when was for them Seita Kochavim, and then the next day, figure 15 minutes before that. Even this isn't 100% clear, because what is the definition of Seita Kochavim? Which kind of stars count or don't count will also not be clear. So I wrote to him, this is my correspondent, Reb Yaakov Levinger, an engineer living in Tel Aviv, whom I've been corresponding on the subject for the last 4 or 5 years. So I wrote to him the other day, I would like your opinion on the next to the last paragraph in Rabbi Ungar's Teshuvah. So he wrote back, this was in the 19th century, I can only guess how things were practiced then, no personal tradition from that time. So he's being very careful about what he answers. Then I wrote to him, how did they know when the time was going to be for Seita Kochavim? It is unlikely that they looked at the stars on Thursday night and used this time for Friday night. So he wrote back to me, it seems that it was done this way. It was a rule of thumb that the difference of Seita Kochavim between two Shabbatot was approximately 10 minutes near the equinoxes for plus or minus 2 months, and no change near the solstices. So don't take this looking at the sky on Thursday night, knowing it for Friday, too strictly. So they made some kind of a combination, a mix between doing a little bit of a calculation. I wrote to him, it is much more likely that they relied on a printed luach as we do, and he says only in the 20th century. He denies that there existed any such luchot from the 19th century. I'm not sure. Okay, then, did they use the calculation of the Chatam Sofer, I wrote to him, derived from Nathan Adler, or what? So he wrote back to me, I never heard in Hungary about these Rabbi Adler data. They were not widely known, and they had no influence on practice. And he's probably right about that. Remember, I wrote to him, that the later they set Seita Kochavim, the more they all may kill on every Shabbat. No, it's if we count everything backwards from Seita Kochavim, if you decide that Seita Kochavim is an hour after sunset, then you get 3/4 of an hour. If you decide that it's an hour and a half after sunset, then you get an hour and a quarter. So the later you postpone your definition of Seita Kochavim, you're being machmir for Saturday night, but you're certainly being mekil for Friday night. He wrote back to me, the rule of 3/4 to an hour for candle lighting before Tseit was widely known. Sometimes candle lighting was after the Shkia, when recalculated now, but Shkia was never considered then. In other words, the idea that the Shkia had something to do with Kabbalat Shabbat was completely foreign to the conceptions in Hungary during that time. I wrote to him, I did not find any luach of this type in the luchot produced in Beinish. Do you have one from this period? And he answered back, in the 19th century there were luchot in Breslau, and they are discussed in the Shuta Chatam Sofer. I don't think they were widely used for halachic times. So he doesn't really know the answer to that question. Then I wrote to him, in fact, what was the practice in Hungary in your time and the time of your parents when this version of Rabbeinu Tam's Shita, counting backwards from Seita Kochavim, was in use? How is the time of Seita Kochavim computed and how is it publicized? Do you have a luach from this period which illustrates this? And he wrote back, in 20th century pre-war Hungary and Germany, including all of Western Europe, etc., candle lighting and Motzei Shabbat were published in printed luchot according to the Bertold Cohn tables, Strasbourg, endorsed by Rev. David Zvi Hoffman, when solar depression was 7.5 degrees below the horizon. Not 6 and not 8.5, the way we currently call the calculator. Bein hashmashot for Brit Milah, Tfilat Mincha, etc., was between 13.5 and 15 minutes from this time backwards. Kabbalat Shabbat, 3/4 of an hour till 1 hour before the above Tseh. B'sha'at Hadchak, much less, till a half an hour B'sha'at Tseh. In other words, if you really had to get some work done or the cooking wasn't finished or something, you would be lighting candles to about a half an hour before that time. In rural areas, Tzeit was fixed by looking at the sky. Bein HaShma showed 15 minutes from the Tzeit of yesterday, measured with the tower clock. So this is how they would be doing in small towns in rural Hungary. See Beinish Volume 2, some German and Hungarian will quote in leaflets of Aguda, etc. From Pressburg, 1936. Shkia, that is astronomical sunset of the upper limbs viewed at the horizon, was not published and not considered for anything, not even for halachot chamurot. So that's the story. He's completely trustworthy as far as his recounting of what the actual practice was in Hungary and in Austria during his time. So Shkia had nothing to do with it. And by that time, they had already calculated Seita Kochavim as 7.5 degrees after a solar depression, which is a good bit after the end of civil twilight, which means that there would be davening mincha when there are many, many stars in the sky, because for some reason or other, those stars didn't really count. Okay, so that's the practice in Hungary, and of course, all of these practices came to an end with the destruction of the Jews in Eastern Europe and in Hungary, and we only have bare memories of it, and the influence of the Lithuanian yeshivas on the so-called practice of waiting 72 minutes after Shkia on Saturday night, that practice never existed anywhere before the 20th century, or maybe in some places in the middle of the 19th century. But the reinterpretation of Rabbeinu Tam, L'chumra, on Saturday night, but not L'kula, on Friday night, is just a distortion of the actual behavior. What took place when Rabbeinu Tam's opinion was accepted was that it was accepted that you can light candles after the Shkia on Friday night, which is L'kula, but nobody took Rabbeinu Tam's Shita L'chumra, that you have to wait this extremely long time on Saturday night. That's a 20th century invention, not a shita that existed for all practical purposes anywhere. And it's mainly an invention of post-World War II. Okay. So, we now have, I think, a fair picture of the facts. And we have some reasonable explanation of the facts. That is, the main shift was the shift that took place in the 16th and 17th century when people began to light candles later, that is, after the physical setting of the sun. And the reasons that went into that were several. One was the fact that the general day shifted back to what it was in Roman times. That is, in medieval times, the day had shifted back by 3 hours. So the ninth hour, nones, which was 3 o'clock in the afternoon in Roman times, became noon, which is the middle of the day in medieval times, and that name stuck to this day. Secondly, there was the advent of less expensive artificial illumination, so that people were actually staying up later. So thirdly, there was the fact that people were traveling away from home to be at these different fairs, so they didn't necessarily keep all the practices of home because they had a little more flexibility. Fourthly, there was the Italian clock, that is, the clock in the middle of the 17th century Poland was one in which the end of the 24th hour came a half an hour or 40 minutes after sunset. So the most modern way of looking at things and what everybody else was doing was that the day ended after it got dark, about a half an hour or 40 minutes after sunset. And finally, no small component in all of this was the invention of the printing press, which meant that the Shulchan Aruch was widely distributed, so that any reasonable Jew had a copy of the Shulchan Aruch available to him, and the Shulchan Aruch said black on white that this whole period of time from sunset until 58 and a half minutes later is voluntary. And if he's away on business and he has some pressing emergency, he doesn't have to spend the whole 58 and a half minutes before Tosefet Shabbat. He can spend 5 minutes for Tosefet Shabbat and work during the permitted period. So the influence of the Shulchan Aruch was exactly the opposite. That is, he did not say what the actual practice was during his time, because there never was such a practice in his time. He stated a purely theoretical opinion derived from texts, and this purely theoretical opinion derived from text had a major impact on practice 100 years later,
because of the invention of the printing press and the distribution of the Shulchan Aruch as an authoritative body. So that's more or less the picture that we get as to what actually happened. Yes? No, he used to, he, what? We will discuss the Rav's practice. He would wait an eighth of a day, an achta. So he would wait an eighth of the sand size of the day. And that's just simply a mistake. It was a mistake he inherited from his grandfather, but we will explain very shortly why that was a mistake. And I had many discussions with him, and he just refused to either accept or understand the astronomical facts that are involved here. But his practice was, if it was a 12-hour day, then he would wait an hour and a half, and comparably, if it was a longer day, he would wait longer, and if it was a short day, like in the middle of the winter, where the day may have been 8 hours long, he would wait only an hour. Okay. From sunrise to sunset, let's say. I think that was his practice, but I had many discussions with him to no avail on this particular topic. Okay, now I want to go back and see what was this theoretical position which was adopted by the Shulchan Aruch, and we can draw a fairly straight line from Rabbeinu Tam to the Ramban to the Shulchan Aruch. But in order to do that, we better spend at least a little bit of time reviewing what the actual astronomical facts are. Because there are two issues here, what actually happens, and then a legal issue of where to draw the dividing line between day and night and one day and the next. And for that, we sort of need to know what is going on. So I will read to you from the handout that I had last time on this, because it's a quote from Rosenberg's book. I'm not passing this out, because I passed this out 4 or 5 years ago, so you all have a copy of it somewhere, but I'll pass out some additional material. It was realized long ago that the colors of sunset and dawn, which for ages have stimulated the imaginations and have favorably and have invariably figured prominently in the religious beliefs and arts of all people, arise in the Earth's atmosphere and are governed by its optical properties. Al-Hazm, the 11th century pioneer of experimental physics, was apparently aware of this fact. It's not clear to me who he attributes the discovery to Al-Hazm. I tend to believe that he's probably right, but I had some long discussions with Professor Sabra, who's the world's expert on Islamic science in the middle of during this period, and he's not so sure that this was Al-Hazm. Okay. He was also the first to attempt a study of the atmosphere itself by interpreting the variations in sky brightness during twilight. Al-Hazm points out that the Earth's shadow rises continually higher during the evening twilight, and that night falls as soon as the whole atmosphere is enveloped in its shadow. By measuring the duration of twilight in terms of the sun's depression below the horizon at nightfall, Al-Hazm was able to estimate the height of the atmosphere at 52,000 paces, not too far from the true value, since we now know that less than 1% of the entire air mass lies above this level. These computations were subsequently corrected by Kepler. Okay, so the main, and for this we can now look at the Rambam in the Perusha Mishnayot on Brachot, where he lived about 100 years after Al-Hazm, so he was aware of this discovery. So in his Perusha Mishnayot on Brachot, he writes, Ba'amud HaShachar, what does the phrase Amud HaShachar mean? Hu Amud Ha'or HaBokeh HaBokeh, that is the pillar of light that breaks in the dawn. Wuhu o yira'eh b'fa'at ha-mizrach, this is the light that is seen at the eastern corner. Kodem alot ha-shemesh kisha'a b'chomesh min ha-sha'ot ha-shavot, this is the light that rises approximately 72 minutes of equal hours before the rise of the sun. So if you calculate 72 minutes at the equator at the equinoxes, that means when the sun is at a depression of about 18 degrees. The sibato, the reason why we see this light, kirvat shetach hekef or hashemesh la'edim hakvedim ha'olim en ha'aretz tamid. This is because the sun's rays hit the vapors that arise continuously from the earth, that means it's hitting the earth's atmosphere. Shagavham al pnei ha'adama 51 mil. Commotion is ba'eva torat ha'madayim. So he gives a figure for 51,000 paces instead of 52,000 paces, but that's obviously the same ballpark figure, and he's getting this from... So the Ramban, at least, in contrast to many of the others who are going to be citing tonight, was well aware of the basic physical and astronomical phenomenon that give rise to the twilight and to dawn and to the change in the light. Okay. All right, now I'm going to continue with my reading from Rosenberg. As the sun drops toward the horizon, the path of its rays through the atmosphere lengthens and their brightness weakens, leading to a decrease in illumination of the Earth's surface, not only by direct sunlight, but also by the light scattered in the atmosphere. Under daytime conditions, the combined illuminance shows its owner a minor dependence on the altitude of the sun. In other words, during most of the day, the amount of light that hits, say, any given horizontal surface remains practically constant. But when the sun has sunk to within 5 to 10 degrees of the horizon, in other words, the sun is still above the horizon, but it's now within 5 to 10 degrees above the horizon, the progressive drop in illuminance begins to accelerate sharply. It is with this accelerated darkening that twilight is considered to have set in. In other words, twilight begins before the sun is setting, but when there is a change in the... Simultaneously, the relative contribution of the rapidly weakening direct solar rays and illuminating the Earth's surface begins to decrease.
Say, if you shalayim, that starts, it won't get, say, another question,
so it's quick. Yeah, it's quick. We'll look at some of the tables and we'll see what the comparison is about to find. Okay. The atmosphere penetrated by the rays of the setting sun increasingly serves as the source of illumination. Instead of getting light directly from the sun, you're getting light from the atmosphere. From the moment of sunset, it remains the sole source of light. But the Earth's shadow gradually rises upward and claims an increasing portion of the atmosphere. The lower atmospheric levels, now submerged in shadow, no longer contribute to the sky brightness, and the scattered light comes more and more from higher layers which are still illuminated by direct sunlight. Since the air density falls off rapidly with height, the scattering coefficient does also. Sunlight is scattered increasingly more weakly, and the sky brightness diminishes, and so the illuminance at the Earth's surface falls. When the sun reaches 10 to 15 degrees below the horizon, the intrinsic glow of the upper atmospheric layers begins to appear together with the starlight, and the illumination conditions gradually approach those of night. The transition to night is usually complete when the sun is depressed between 17 to 19 degrees below the horizon. And that's the 18 degrees that the Rambam was mentioning as a rough figure. From the practical need to estimate conditions of visibility at various times of day, there's historically grown up a tradition of dividing twilight into three stages, depending upon the amount of twilight illumination. The brightest portion of twilight, when the natural light is an open space is enough to allow any task, including reading, is to be carried on, has received the name of civil twilight. In other words, while you can continue going about your business, including be able to read outside of the natural illumination, that is called civil twilight. There is no unanimous agreement regarding its boundary. Depressions of the sun from 6 to 8 degrees below the horizon have been variously adopted. In recent years, however, most authors have preferred the first figure. So, the usual definition in the almanacs of the end of civil twilight is when the sun is 6 degrees below the horizon. Next comes nautical or navigational twilight, during which small details are lost in the darkness, but outlines of large objects, such as shorelines, are fairly distinct. The recognized boundaries are solar depressions of 6 and 12 degrees below the horizon, so that by the end of nautical twilight, we can only make out clearly the horizon line. Finally, nautical twilight gives way to astronomical twilight, which continues until the sun is depressed by 18 degrees below the horizon, whereupon night sets in. During this period, the illumination conditions can hardly be distinguished from night, but the sky is still noticeably light enough to hinder astronomical observations. The levels of illumination corresponding to the boundaries between the subtle stages of twilight are on the average 2.5 looks for solar depression angles of 6 degrees, 6 times 10 to the minus 3 looks for solar depressions of 12 degrees, and 6 times 10 to the minus 4 looks for solar depressions of 18 degrees. And here is a bit of a curve as to what happens. During the day, the amount of light is fairly constant, and then it begins to fall rapidly, and there is the end of astronomical twilight. So those are the bare facts, and maybe we should also... What?
It's interesting because as you go, as I mentioned to you last week, if you're in an airplane, you're higher up. Twilight lasts that much longer.
Sure.
And you don't have the... Sorry? Besides the horizon being your... The whole atmospheric condition is different the higher up you are.
Okay, now here are two pretty...
These definitions are maybe observatory website, the official U.S. definition.
Yes, yes, and I Xeroxed some pages from the Nautical Almanac, so we'll test them out also. Okay, so I'm now going to read a little bit from this book, which is an excellent, a classic of its type, for The Nature of Light and Color in the Open Air, by Minna Ehrt. So... The following is a description of a typical sunset in our part of the world. Our part of the world means Amsterdam, which is 52 degrees, more or less, latitude. We're 42, and Yerushalayim is about 32. Okay, half an hour before sunset. The color of the sky near the horizon changes into a warm yellow or yellow-red, a color entirely different from the usual whitish-blue seen there by day. The horizontal stripes below the sun become faintly visible as a long yellowish band of color. Above them, concentrically around the sun, a large, very luminous whitish patch of light, the bright glow, often bounded by a fairly indicated brown ring. If there are white clouds near the eastern horizon, they assume a soft red hue, and I've made copies of this to test out, and the sky above them shows the upper part of the counter twilight. That's what, before the sun actually sets. Here's the next page in this book. Sun's attitudes, 0 degrees sunset. But do not think that the twilight phenomena are over now. The interesting part is just beginning. In the west, along the horizon, lies the color of horizontal stripes, the colors from below upwards being white, yellow, yellow, and green. Above it, the magnificent bright glow, transparent and white, is encircled by the brown wing, its height reaching as far as 50 degrees. In the east, now this is very important for us, in the east, the Earth's shadow begins to rise almost as the same time as the sun begins to set. It's a very striking bluish-gray segment, shifting gradually across the purple layer, and as a rule, it cannot be followed further than about 6 degrees above the horizon. Occasionally, it seems as if a trace of the Earth's shadow is visible a long time before the sun begins to set, but this is simply a layer of dust or mist. So that's at sunset, there's going to be a layer of pink in the east, whereas the sun is setting in the west. Sun's attitude, -1 to -2 degrees, 10 minutes after sunset. In the west, horizontal stripes from below upwards become brown, orange, and yellow. The bright glow with its brown ring reaches a height of 40 degrees. In the east, the Earth's shadow rises higher and higher, and everything within it now is of a dull, uniform hue, more or less green-blue. The counter twilight develops this border of colors from below upwards, violet, crimson, orange, yellow, green, blue, and above that, a bright reflection. So that's about 10 minutes after sunset. Sun's attitude, -2 to -3 degrees, 15 to 20 minutes after sunset. It describes what's happening, and you see a picture of all of these things happening in the east and in the west. I don't have to read it. And finally, did I pass this out? This is a discussion of what happens in the various times that go on. And here is a Xerox from a somewhat less famous and not as good popular American book as opposed to a Dutch book. And here's a table listing the events that actually occur after sunset one page. So, he claims that you can actually see some of the zero magnitude stars before the sun actually sets. I've never seen zero magnitude stars before the sun actually sets, but you can see the major planets, Venus and Jupiter and such, before the sun sets, if you know where to look. If you look, and he's writing at latitude 40 degrees, New York, as opposed to Amsterdam. He writes that between 4 and 5 degrees of solar depression, you begin to see the second magnitude stars. So that's within 20 to 25 minutes after the sunset. And the civil twilight, according to him, ends at 30 minutes after sunset. And by definition, that's when the sun is 6 degrees below the horizon.
When was this written?
This,
yeah.
Picked it up in Barnes & Noble.
So 1983.
Yeah, things haven't changed. Okay. So you can see where various things are happening. For example, when the solar attitude is 8 degrees below the horizon, already fifth magnitude stars are visible. So therefore, our current practice of waiting on Say Shabbat till 8.5 degrees below the horizon is an incredible chumrah, because by this time, just about every star that's going to be visible, certainly here with the fog or with the city lights, is already visible. Okay.
I remember as a child, we went into shul, which then children have to tell us to look at these stars.
Right.
And if we looked at these stars, then they were able to dominate.
Right. We'll see that. That comes from the Gemara, and that's the way practice always was. But now we don't do that anymore. We listen to what is announced in the shul as to when is the earliest time you can make Havdalah. He gets it on the web from the Young Israel, and they get it from somewhere, and it's not at all clear. Okay. Here is a Xerox of the Nautical Almanac for, here's for June, which is when the day is longest. And here's for December, when the day is shortest, the middle.
Daylight.
Daylight, well, the shortest. And here is what happened for March. I thought I made a lot of copies of March, but apparently not. You'll have to trust me on this. Maybe I should go up and make some copies for March. Well, let's I'm relying on the assumption.
When one thinks, let's say, Pesach is around March 30th, mm-hmm. on an average day, average year, March 30th.
Mm-hmm.
Lift benching, usually Pesach as it is Sukkot, is about 6:30. 6:15 to 6:30, so it makes.
Okay. But
so it does make sense.
Right. All right. Now, let's take a look at the same thing on June 21st. So then the sun sets at 19:32, and the end of civil twilight is at 20:05. So there's a 33-minute difference. Right? So
what do you see?
Okay? Mm-hmm. And now, so 27 minutes at the spring equinox approximately. I got the 23rd instead of the 21st, so it'll be a little bit less. And then 33 minutes, and then if we take a look at the December, it's 31 minutes. Okay? The point here is that the length of twilight is a few minutes longer. It's shortest at the spring, it's longest at the summer, but it also is longer at the winter solstice than it is at the spring equinox. In other words, the curve that looks like that. It goes up, it comes down, and then goes up a little bit again. It's more striking than, for example. The important point here is that I never succeeded in getting across to the road, for example, is that the length of twilight is longer in the winter than it is at the spring. It's longest in the summer. It goes up from spring to summer, reaches a maximum, comes back down to the smallest again at the September 21st, or whenever the fall equinox is, but then it rises again to reach. Okay, good question. Let's take a look at a real high longitude. Let's take a look at say, high latitude. Let's look at, say, 58. That's the next. So at 58, on March 23rd, the sun set at 1823, and the civil twilight ended at 1902. So what is that? That's 39 minutes. Okay? At the summer, the sun set at 2107, and the end of civil twilight was at 2223, so that's an hour and 16 minutes. Okay? And what did we say it was in the spring? 39? And now if we look in December, it sunset at 1512, and the end of civil twilight is 1604, so that's 52 minutes. So again, it's considerably longer in the winter than it was at the spring. What's the problem?
I'm just making
a. Yeah. So you had a long dawn. That's right. This is that's right. That's right. So, for example, right. So, for example, if you look at this 58 degrees, there is no astronomical twilight. The sun never gets that far below the horizon. There's no nautical twilight. The sun never gets 12 degrees below the horizon at the middle of the summer. And that's what you saw in Ufa. Okay. So.
No.
The maximum is greater at the summer than it is at the winter. It goes like this, then it comes up again. The two minima are the same height, but the one maximum is lower than the other maximum. It may or may not make sense, but this is the fact. When I tried to give a shiur on this topic a couple of years ago at a yeshiva, it took me, unfortunately, almost a whole hour to explain why this was true by getting a globe and explaining it. So I figure tonight I'm not even going to try to explain why this is true. We'll just take it as an existing fact that twilight is longer in wintertime than it is in the spring. And therefore, the Rav's custom of declaring that the length of twilight is proportional to the length of the day is just simply wrong. Whatever the Ben Hashmasha is, it should be correlated in some way to twilight. And twilight is longer in the wintertime than it is in the spring, whereas, according to the Rav's calculation, it's much shorter in the wintertime than it is in the.
Body of the sharp.
Well, yeah, because he would take a fraction of the day. If the day was much shorter, the day, in fact, is much shorter in the winter time than it is in the spring.
That's hard to argue.
No one is going to argue, but the fact that twilight is longer is not well known. And I just
somehow say... Intuitive. Somehow counterintuitive. But you think that, you know, in the winter that would be shorter, that's...
Suppose you're, I'll give this 2 minutes, but no longer try. Suppose you're standing at the equator. So let's eliminate the effect of latitude on this altogether. Suppose you're standing at the equator. Then at the spring or fall equinoxes, the sun is directly overhead. So as the sun is going below the horizon, it's going very, very fast compared to say, if you're standing at the same position in the middle of the summer or the middle of the winter, when the sun is no longer directly overhead, but it's further north. So it's going around the same number of degrees of rotation of the Earth, but because it's at a circle which is above the equator, it's moving less below the horizon. If you thought of the sun as actually having reached the North Pole, it would never go below the horizon. So the idea is that because the sun is not moving on the circle,